Epilepsy. It affects millions and can lead to sudden death. This hour, a look at a new research initiative. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We'll speak this hour with neuroscientist Dr. George Richardson of the University of Iowa about his research into something called sudden unexpected death in epilepsy. It's the leading cause of death from epilepsy. We'll also hear from family members of Iowans with the disorder, and we'll find out why some parents of children with epilepsy are still not satisfied with Iowa's highly celebrated new cannabis oil law. Conversation as we discuss epilepsy this hour. First, a look at the news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Epilepsy, it affects millions, and yet there is so much about this neurological disorder and the seizures it causes that is not understood. There is no doubt, though, that it affects many million Americans. One in 26 people in the U.S. will develop epilepsy at some point in their lifetime. Over 2 million people in the U.S. have this neurological disorder. Worldwide, that figure is some 65 million people. And a third of people with epilepsy live with uncontrollable seizures because no available treatment works for them. This hour, we want to talk about new research efforts going on here in Iowa to better understand epilepsy, also to understand the leading cause of death from epilepsy called sudden unexpected death in epilepsy. It goes by the acronym SUDEP, and to talk with family members of Iowans with this disorder. If you'd like to join our conversation, has epilepsy touched you or a loved one? What are your questions? What are your concerns? 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Email us if you'd like, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Iowa Public Radio is also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio, at IPR Talk. Excuse me, tweet us at IPR Talk. Joining me in the studio in Iowa City to kick off our show, we have Dr. George Richardson. He is a University of Iowa professor and chair of neurology, also the Roy J. Carver Chair in Neuroscience at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine, a researcher who has been treating and researching epilepsy for many years. Dr. Richardson, welcome to our studio.
Thank you very much.
Also joining us, Teresa Elliott from Montezuma, Iowa. Teresa Elliott is the mother of a 30-year-old, Ryan Elliott, who passed away during his sleep a few months ago. Teresa Elliott, welcome to our studio here in Iowa City.
Thank you.
And our condolences. I'm very sorry for the loss of your son.
Thank you very much.
Before we talk a little bit more about this sudden unexpected death in epilepsy, Dr. Richardson, please set the stage by telling us what is epilepsy and how does SUDEP fit in to the context of this neurological disorder?
So epilepsy is defined as the condition of chronic recurrent seizures. Many people have seizures, but only one or two maybe in their life, but those who have chronic recurrent seizures are at risk of a number of different types of problems. And SUDEP is really a huge problem that only recently became recognized. It is defined as the death of a person with epilepsy without any known cause on the basis of autopsy and not due to an accident. And it's extremely common. So you mentioned the numbers for epilepsy patients. 15% of those patients will die from SUDEP. And of the third that are refractory, 35% of those will die. And in Iowa, that means that there's somewhere between 10 and 15,000 Iowans that are at very high risk of this problem. And it strikes with a peak incidence right at 30 years of age. Mm-hmm. Let me read a quote from a mother that I think is, from a father that I think is very poignant. This is about his 17-year-old stepdaughter who died shortly after an epileptic seizure. She rose from dinner about 4 o'clock in better health and spirits than she appeared to have been in for some time, soon after which she was seized with one of her usual fits and expired in it in less than 2 minutes, without uttering a word, a groan, or scarce a sigh. This sudden and unexpected blow, I scarce need add, has almost reduced my poor wife to the lowest ebb of misery. So that was a quote from George Washington, our first president, and it was about his stepdaughter, Martha's daughter. And so most people don't know that about our president.
But you said, even though you're quoting George Washington, you're saying this sudden, unexpected death is something that has only been recently recognized.
So it's only been recently recognized to be as common as it is, and only as what its causes are. And so when I was in medical school and I went to a place that was very good in epilepsy, I was taught that seizures are benign. They usually end in 5 minutes. If they don't, you need to start worrying about them, but that was a very low percentage of the total, and we should just watch patients. And then lo and behold, about 10 years ago, 15 years ago, it became clear that half of seizures cause people to stop breathing, and a large number of seizures also cause the heart to slow down and sometimes to stop. So they aren't as benign as we used to think, and I think that message has not really been made clear to most physicians and most patients. And so I think that problem of people not knowing about it is really the issue. It's probably that people weren't really talking about it as much for many different reasons. And it's also a problem that the ability to diagnose it is very difficult because there's no test you can do on autopsy that proves that it's SUDEP. It's a description, and it turns out to be very similar to sudden infant death syndrome in that you don't have a way to absolutely diagnose it. You rule other things out, and you're left with that as what we call a diagnosis of exclusion. So that's the problem. And then there may be also some issues of perhaps paternalism of physicians not wanting to make people with seizures be too worried about this. But when you poll parents, they overwhelmingly want to know what the risks are. And those people who weren't told and then had a family member who died are very often resentful of not being told.
Dr. Richardson, let's turn now to Teresa Elliott, mother from Montezuma, Iowa. Your son, your 30-year-old son, Elliot, died this past August in his sleep. He was diagnosed a few years earlier with epilepsy. When did symptoms first occur that you, it was in his 20s before you knew he had epilepsy?
Yes, he was 25, 26 when he was diagnosed, and he had his first seizure the summer of 2010. And I remember very clearly the morning he called me and said, "I'm in the ER, Mom. I just had a seizure." And I was just blown away because this just came out of nowhere.
Did he tell you, what were those early seizures like?
He had the tonic-clonic seizures with the, you know, the grand mal. Mm-hmm. So he,
for someone who is not acquainted with epilepsy, describe a seizure. Can you, doctor, help us out with that?
Sure.
What is the range of seizures?
So seizures can involve a variety of different types of manifestation depending upon what part of the brain is involved. And we break it up into two general types. One is when the entire brain becomes involved at the same time, and another where it begins in one part of the brain and then can sometimes spread. The ones that, it'll take me too long to go into all the different types, but the main main two types people think about are called generalized tonic-clonic seizures or grand mal seizures, and that's when somebody immediately loses consciousness and stiffens up and then perhaps shakes after that for a period of time, and then afterwards is unresponsive for a period of 5 minutes to an hour, and then slowly wakes up, returns to normal. Another type of seizure is when only a small part of the brain is involved, and that can sometimes occur with people doing all kinds of things that are apparently that you're not aware that they're a seizure. Like they may pick at their shirt or smack their lips, but not be responsive to what you're saying. I had a patient once who rode his bicycle 2 miles while he was having a seizure without crashing.
And for the person with epilepsy having a seizure, the experience is like what?
For them, they're unaware of what's happening at the time. I've had patients tell me that to them it doesn't bother them at all. They just lose time and they wake up and they're fine. If they have a grand mal seizure, they may be kind of sore from all that activity. But the person that is there with them, their wife or their mother, father, that's who it bothers the most because they see the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Teresa Elliott, your son started having seizures in 2010. With what regularity? How often?
He had his first one in June, and then he had another one, I'm saying, around July. And that was when they made the diagnosis, when he had had two seizures. And then probably every 3 to 4 months, he would have a seizure.
Hmm. Oh, what sort of treatment was he given?
He was first given a drug called Keppra. And
did that help?
For a while. And then he had to go. As he went on, he got older, they added another drug, Topamax, which he was on, which he absolutely hated because he had word-finding difficulties, and he was feeling it was affecting his work, and that was another thing. He really didn't tell anyone at work that he had epilepsy. There were a few close, you know, coworkers that knew, but that was it. And he minimized it a lot. He just didn't want it to be a big part of his life.
Mm-hmm. So 4 years pass until his sudden, unexpected death. How unexpected was it to you?
Devastating. Yeah, it was. We had no idea. I mean, we would just, you know, like Dr. Richardson had said, thought it was a benign condition, and you know, he was just going to have to live with it, and you know, we would live with it with him, and you know, he would live to a ripe old age. But that was
had you heard of a sudden unexpected death in epilepsy before this?
Not
before
at
he
all.
Died?
Not at all.
Not at all. So the point the doctor is making about lack of awareness definitely out there. You undoubtedly wish you had heard about it.
Definitely, definitely. I think it would have helped.
Mm-hmm. Among people with epilepsy, what are the risk factors? What do we know about the risk factors for sudden unexpected death in epilepsy, Doctor?
Well, that's one of the main focuses of the work that the group that I'm part of is doing, is trying to identify those things that are the highest risk factors. We don't completely know about those yet. One that's the most obvious or the most clear is just having lots of seizures. The more seizures you have, the more likely you will die from them. There's also grand mal seizures are more likely to cause death than complex partial seizures, even though they both cause you to decrease your breathing and decrease your heart rate about the same amount. Beyond that, it's not completely clear. And so we're looking right now for tests to be able to identify those.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the research a little bit more in depth. You are one of the University of Iowa neuroscientists joining with other research groups. You have other neuroscientists here at the University of Iowa, the College of Medicine, working together with other groups around the world on this SUDEP, specifically on this on SUDEP, the sudden unexpected death in epilepsy, the leading cause of death from epilepsy. Tell us a little bit more about it. About $6 million received in 2014 toward these research efforts?
Well, all told, it'll be $29 million divided among the 8 different groups and over 5 years. With a variety of different approaches being used, animal studies, cell studies, stem cell studies, autopsy studies, clinical research measurements of seizures inside a epilepsy monitoring unit in the hospital, and trying to identify, number one, what causes SUDEP, what its risk factors are, what we can do to identify those patients at highest risk, what we can do to treat those patients, and you know, medications, devices, and also what we can do to increase awareness and understanding about the condition.
What do we know about the causes? Some 2 million Americans with epilepsy, something you're born with, something that you have possibly in your DNA, but also the environment can play a part in?
So epilepsy can be caused by genetic factors or acquired factors, and the ones that are genetic generally appear sometime during early life, childhood. And those from acquired causes generally occur, you know, in adulthood, and trauma is a very common cause of that, head trauma. Strokes, tumors can do it in older age. But the younger people, it's generally genetic. And any cause of epilepsy can cause SUDEP. But there's a very little we know about actual SUDEP, because in any individual, they may go through many, many seizures through their lifetime without a problem, and then finally their last seizure is one that kills them. And the reason for the difference between the one that kills them and those that don't is what, you know, that's a big mystery. But it's generally grand mal seizures, and it's very common for people to be found in bed, face down, after the seizure occurred. And we have a little bit of information from patients who've actually died in the hospital while being monitored. And there's a paper that recently came out a year ago describing 11 patients that happened to over a very long period of time. And in each of those cases, there was problems with the heart and breathing after the seizure that ultimately patients did not recover from. So they just stopped breathing and their heart slowed down. And the fact that they were face down in bed may make it so that they're unable to breathe well because their face is in a pillow, so that the arousal from being in that position was probably an issue.
You mentioned awareness is not where it should be, and that's one of the goals is to raise awareness, also the goal of this program. Why is awareness important? If Ryan, if Teresa and her husband had known about this possibility of sudden unexpected death, what could have been done otherwise, given that we know so little about it, and it's exactly the reason you're researching it?
So I could say for sure that the most important thing for preventing SUDEP is to prevent seizures. And I don't know about Ryan's case, but there are many patients across the state, across the country, for whom the doctor feels that having a seizure a week is okay, that that's reasonable control. But it's really not, and there are many things that can be done to aggressively treat seizures.
So it's a matter of educating our primary care physicians.
Correct, as well as the patients. And we often are contacted by the patients directly because they've read about something on the web or learned through friends about the risk. And so then being able to identify what kind of epilepsy they have, what kind of medication would be the most likely to help with that kind of epilepsy, trying them on that medication, adding another one if that doesn't work, adding a third if that doesn't work, ultimately perhaps considering epilepsy surgery, removing the part of the brain that's causing the seizure, can be very, very effective in those patients who don't respond to multiple medications.
Teresa Elliott, what are your hopes about this new research?
Our hope is that they can hopefully find the one trigger, or if there is one trigger that causes the SUDEP, and if it can just help one family, two families, just, you know, get the word out there and, you know, make it known that there is a risk with the epilepsy.
Okay. Let's go to caller. Sean is with us in Marion. Hello, Sean. Has epilepsy touched you or your family?
Yes, my dad had it. And I remember catching maybe the tail end of the seizure and really scared the living, you know, what out of me. But I remember my dad had to pass a series of tests to get his driver's license back. And he was able, he passed the test and he got his driver's license back. But the thing that really got me is that we were at a truck stop. Then my mom and I were at a truck stop in like mid-90s. And there was another customer in there that was going through a grandma epileptic seizure. And my dad, his comment was, "So that's what I look like going through those." And he had this look of amazement, like, "I survived that." Mm. This look of amazement was just, you know, just really got to me. And I goes, "Don't you remember?" He goes, "No, I don't remember anything about my seizures." And since that was my first one I ever seen go from start to finish, I was amazed too at how my dad was able to survive it. And I guess I got a medical question about epilepsy.
We're coming up on a break. Please be brief, Sean. Thanks.
Okay. I remember my dad trying to donate blood, and since he said that he had epilepsy, they wouldn't take it. Is there any medical reason why epileptic patients cannot donate blood?
Not that I'm aware of.
This is not a transmissible disease. This is a neurological disorder, and you can't transmit that through blood?
Correct. Mm-hmm. You know, unless he had an infectious cause of epilepsy, but that would not be likely.
Can you get epilepsy from some sort of infection?
There are infections that can do it. Generally, they're not transmissible from blood to blood, though.
What about this genetic component? Teresa Elliott and her family, do they need to be more, if you have epilepsy in your family, do you need to be more concerned about it if you're in that bloodline?
Those who have genetic epilepsy, it's usually apparent. It's known that there is a genetic predisposition because somebody else in the family would have had it. If you have two people in your family that have epilepsy, then generally that's not felt to be at a level that would make you think of genetic epilepsy. If you have three or more, then you would start thinking about genetic causes. And some genetic causes actually can occur spontaneously, so a person has a problem that's genetic that they can pass on to their children, but they didn't have anybody else in their family that had it.
We're coming up on a break, Dr. Richardson. We have a pie chart in front of us, and I want you just to tell me briefly, if we have the knowns and the unknowns about epilepsy in a pie chart, how big are the knowns compared to the unknowns?
I'd say maybe, that's a tough one, but maybe a third is known and 2/3 is not, but that's very general. And the very fine details we know less about.
Okay, we'll be back in just a moment. We're going to talk more about epilepsy and new research on the leading cause of death from epilepsy called sudden unexpected death in epilepsy, research being done here in Iowa. What do you wish we knew about epilepsy? How has epilepsy affected you or your family or your friends? 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Iowa Public Radio is also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. I'm Ben Kiefer, back with more of River to River after a short break. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, talking about epilepsy this hour and new research on the leading cause of death from epilepsy. It goes by the acronym SUDEP. That stands for Sudden Unexpected Death in Epilepsy. And we're talking today with a leading researcher in that area, Dr. George Richardson of the University of Iowa, University of Iowa professor and chair of neurology, also the Roy J. Carver chair in neuroscience at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. And they have joined with seven or eight other research groups across the world to increase the understanding of sudden unexpected death in epilepsy. And it turns out that our awareness is growing in recent years about this. And I want to turn to Dr. Richardson and to tell us a little bit more before we go to callers. We want to have those whose loved ones have been touched by epilepsy with your questions, your comments, your concerns. Dial 1-866-780-9100. Dr. Richard, talk a little bit more about what you see as possible prevention for SUDEP.
So one other thing that we are increasingly becoming aware of that may help is if a patient is under supervision, sleeps in a room with another person, and has a seizure, then the simple act of turning them over and shaking them may make it so that they can breathe better and may bring them out of the postictal state or the postictal coma faster. And that may be, there's some evidence that that may actually be very helpful. So that's one thing people should be aware of. In the future, I think there is the potential for devices that might be able to be used to prevent people from having death occur, perhaps once we know the cause.
Well, for a device that could be hooked up to maybe an app that could alarm someone in the household that someone is possibly having a seizure based on body movements?
Correct. So usually the seizures that cause SUDEP are fairly violent, and so even one of the apps that just you put your mobile phone on your bed next to you could potentially alert somebody. And in the future, there may be some devices that might stimulate you to breathe without intervention from another person or cause your heart to speed up.
Aren't there also service dogs who can identify a seizure coming on?
That's a little bit of a difficult question to answer. I think coming on the warning dogs are sometimes less effective, but once a person has a seizure, then I think a dog could act to stimulate somebody by licking them in the face or something like that. So that could be a potential avenue for basically stimulation. And then in the future, there may be some medications that may be more effective at causing you to breathe or keeping your heart from slowing down too much.
With this new research initiative, what to date are the most promising of these studies or the areas that you're looking at?
So I couldn't say that any one is really at the leading edge, but there's some evidence that drugs that affect serotonin may be helpful in a certain population of patients. Some devices that people are looking at have some promise just for alerting family members that there's a seizure occurring. So I think devices, serotonergic drugs, possibly the best.
Neuroscientist Dr. George Richardson joining us of the University of Iowa. Join our conversation as we talk about epilepsy, 1-866-780-9100. Roxanne Cogill is with us, Director of Iowa Epilepsy Services at the Epilepsy Foundation of North Central Illinois, Iowa, and Nebraska. That's a nonprofit for epilepsy education and support in our Des Moines studio. Roxanne, are you there?
Yes.
Hi. You have also a personal interest in this. You are, the mother of a child, a daughter now 10 years old?
Correct.
Who has epilepsy. Give us some background on your daughter's case, please.
Our daughter was diagnosed with epilepsy at the age of 2. And like many other people, we were under the assumption that the medications were going to control her epilepsy. And we quickly learned that her epilepsy, we were told that she was intractable with epilepsy within the first few months of her diagnosis. She had multiple types of seizures. Her seizures affected the autonomic portion of her brain. And that's when we were told in February of 2007 that she was at very high risk for SUDEP because of the type of seizures she had, the frequency of her seizures. And when the seizures affect the autonomic portion of your brain, that's the portion of your brain that affects your heart rate, your breathing. And she would often turn blue. Her face, her lips would turn bluish, purplish color. But we were told not to worry about it, that it was just a pigment change. And As far as the cause, we do have epilepsy that do run on my husband's side of the family as well as my side of the family. But we were and we even have a nephew who has benign Rolandic epilepsy, but we were told that the type that our daughter had was not genetic. We come later on, we found out that there was just not enough research to know that. But she did have a clinical diagnosis of Rasmussen's encephalitis, which affects half the brain. And then later on, she was also diagnosed with cortical dysplasia. But when we were told that she was at high risk for SUDEP, it took a long time. We still continued to try and fail numerous seizure medications. And when we were told that the right half of her brain was shrinking and disappearing, and the only way that we could rescue her from her seizures was to remove half her brain, it's a procedure called a hemispherectomy. That's what we had to do. And we were told that she was at much greater risk of dying from the seizures or the after effects from the seizures itself from SUDEP than from that horrific brain surgery.
When did the brain surgery take place then?
In March of 2009.
How has she been since?
She's been completely seizure-free. It stopped her seizures cold in its tracks.
Wonderful. What about other areas of function, given that a large part of her brain was taken away?
It's pretty amazing with neuroplasticity, being able to reorganize. She learned how to hold her head up, how to sit up, how to walk again. She does wear a leg brace, and she functions with one hand. She doesn't have any fine motor skills on that weak side, but she had lost 60% of her motor functions on that weak side prior to the surgery.
In terms of communication, how is she?
Oh, she talks, she walks, she plays soccer.
Wonderful.
She dances, she does all sorts of activities. And she'll always be delayed, but it's nothing. The challenges now are nothing compared to fighting those seizures. Once we got the seizures under control, she could communicate with us better. She's down to just one seizure medication instead of four seizure medications. When she was on all those seizure medications, there was at one point when she was in preschool that our neurologist told us that she became toxic on it. And it was very scary for us.
Okay. Tell us briefly. We've got a line full of people who want to chip in with their experiences, their questions, but I want to make sure I understand the types of services that your organization, your direct, the Iowa Epilepsy Services at the Epilepsy Foundation of North Central Illinois, Iowa, Nebraska. It's a nonprofit. What types of services, what are you aiming for?
Well, I'm the director of Iowa, and we provide support and services to individuals and families, and we have support groups throughout the state. We provide a free annual epilepsy education conference for families and professionals, and we also provide free trainings on seizure recognition, first aid, and safety to a variety of groups. Especially, we do a lot of trainings for school staff, school nurses, and classrooms, agencies, direct care providers, law enforcement, emergency personnel. We will travel the state at no cost to keep on educating. And we also participate in a lot of advocacy as well.
And you see that we have a long ways to go in terms of raising awareness among those with epilepsy, their families, also primary care physicians about SUDEP.
Absolutely. And the Epilepsy Foundation started the SUDEP Institute in collaboration with a multiple of other epilepsy organizations across the United States. And we've incorporated SUDEP education into our annual epilepsy conferences. We visit with neurologists. We have educational pieces that the neurologists can hand out to families. So I will say some neurologists are still reluctant to talk about SUDEP with their patients. We find that the epileptologists are talking about it to every patient that walks through their door, though.
Dr. Richardson, why that reluctance of physicians to talk about this risk once epilepsy is diagnosed?
I think it's multifactorial. Certainly, part of it is many primary care physicians don't understand epilepsy as well as a neurologist or epilepsy doctor. They feel uncomfortable with exactly what SUDEP is and what's causing it. So that's part of it. There's always been a sense of paternalism among some physicians, especially older ones. I think it's much more common for younger ones to talk about this with their patients because I think there was the concern that telling somebody they might be at risk of dying from any one of their seizures would be something that would affect their life adversely because they'd be worried about it. But overwhelmingly, I think people are more concerned about not knowing what risks are, and they do, I think, resent it if they find out that that's been withheld from them. But but a lot of it has to do with lack of knowledge. You know, SUDEP has not been taught in medical schools across this country, and at most medical schools, it still isn't. So many physicians just don't know about it. Neurologists now are knowing about it. All epilepsy doctors know about it.
Okay, we have about 10 minutes left. We want to continue our conversation about epilepsy. New research on the leading cause of death from epilepsy. It's called Sudden Unexpected Death in Epilepsy. Let's go to our phones and get a sample there of our callers. Jonathan from Osceola, welcome to our program.
Hello. How are you guys doing?
I'm doing fine. How has this touched your life?
Well, I was about 22 years old when I had moved back into the United States from working in Central America and had my first seizure. They originally thought I might have been fainting from heart issues, but found out that it was grand mal tonic-clonic seizures. And I have had numerous EEGs and sleep-deprived EEGs trying to cause a seizure. And I still, 5 years later, have gone around the nation and am undiagnosed. So I was kind of curious how common that is to be unable to diagnose the type of epilepsy and what sort of problems come along with that.
Have you ever heard of SUDEP before hearing this program?
No, I had not. I have not had a single neurologist, and I'm a doctor myself, a PhD, and I have not had a single neurologist tell me what this is.
Hmm. Dr. Richardson, so we really do have a huge lack of awareness, don't we?
Yes.
If someone with that background does not know about SUDEP.
It's an absolutely huge problem. And so that's why I think it's so important to have a radio show like this talk about it. I think that the question was, you know, how often do we go without diagnosing the cause of epilepsy? And that happens less and less as we become better able to, do the right tests. But it's not completely uncommon to not be able to identify the cause.
There undoubtedly, if Jonathan is calling from Osceola with his background, there are undoubtedly those out there who've had epileptic seizures or family members of those who've had them who are now listening to this wondering, what do I do? What can we say about what they should do if the primary care physician has perhaps diagnosed it, not even mentioned a sudden unexpected death in epilepsy as a possibility?
Well, so the place that you can start is to go onto the web and read about it and arm yourself with as much knowledge. The next thing you can do is go talk to your primary care doctor and ask them to discuss it with you and what your risks are and what perhaps you can do to reduce that risk. And if they're unable to be able to control your seizures, then requesting a referral to a neurologist or epilepsy doctor, I think, is a very important step because, as I said earlier, it can be difficult to choose which medications for what type of seizure, and there's many possibilities now. Mm-hmm. Many more medications now available than there used to be.
Jonathan and Osceola, thank you for your. Did you have a quick one?
Well, I was just going to say, and within doing research, would it be best to go through medical journals that are available? Because I work for a university, but is there a lot of false information, I guess, over it that's available on the web as well for other people listening?
About SUDEP, I think there is some false information, but if you go to websites like the Epilepsy Foundation or the SUDEP Institute or the American Epilepsy Society. Those are, there are physicians on those boards that are helping to make sure the information on those websites is correct.
Okay, thank you, Jonathan, for calling from Osceola. We wanted to also invite another guest into our conversation before the hour comes to an end. In our Des Moines studio, Maria LaFrance is with us, Des Moines mother of a 13-year-old epileptic son. Quincy is your son. Maria, welcome to our program.
Thank you, and hello.
Hi. We want to make sure we touch upon what has been in the news in this past year. You are a Des Moines mother who would like to treat your son's epilepsy with cannabis oil. You've been advocating for this in the State House at Iowa, the Capitol, for years. Now, last year, Iowa passed this highly celebrated marijuana law, which allows the use of cannabis oil to treat epilepsy. How has that been going? You're not satisfied?
Well, my son's not actually on it at the moment, so no one can call DHS on me, okay? and I don't have any in my house either.
Okay.
So the law passed, yes, but in order to be free from prosecution, you have to have a card, and the availability of those cards is not we can't get the cards yet.
So your doctor provides documentation, you submit that and get a card.
Right.
That says you may have it, but is it accessible anywhere in Iowa?
No. And last year, you know, for somebody to be really seeking cannabis for an illness, they have to either be desperate or stupid to want to break the law. And we're in the desperate category. My son has failed about 30 medications.
How do you
he's
know?
He's not seizure-free.
How do you know cannabis oil will be some relief?
Well, I don't. I don't know about that, about any of the dangerous drugs that we try, but we keep trying because we don't want to lose him. We love him. I mean, he gave me several hugs this morning, and I love that. But I'm hearing stories. I belong to a support group for Dravet children, which my son has the Dravet diagnosis, which just is means horrible, horrible seizures, basically. We see children have 80 to 90 to 100% seizure reduction using some form of cannabis, whether it's cannabis oil, whether it's this Epidiolex, which is British purified cannabis, whether it's THCA, which is a raw cannabis that people put into a tincture. Some parents are vaporizing cannabis. So it's just an option that should be out there for parents.
So those of us who are not directly affected by this thought the cannabis oil exception would make some difference to people in your situation with your son, Quincy. What needs to happen, in your view, that it is truly something that solves a problem?
Well, the parents that are having the best success have the freedom to experiment, that whether they can increase the dose, decrease the dose, add in some THC, try
with medical supervision?
Strains. Correct. Mm-hmm. So those parents that have actually been trying it either clandestinely, and there's several in Iowa, or with support of their doctor, they're getting more control. My son is just such a severe case. I did try it last year. He improved after about a week. Then he had more seizures, and then I guess I chickened out. And then I would wait until I thought maybe it would be a good time to try it. Because with uncontrolled seizures, you want a baseline. With any kind of medication, you want to get to where you're only changing one thing at a time. And so it's not as straightforward as it is for somebody with maybe a couple seizures a month or two or three seizures a month. My son has... Mm-hmm. Sometimes 100 a day.
We don't have much time, but Dr. Richardson, I'd like you to comment on this, that the new law passed, cannabis oil. Do you see that fitting into your research any at all for prevention or understanding how it works?
So we study Dravet syndrome both in patients. I work with Doug Nordley at Northwestern, who has a large patient population with Dravet, and we have mice with the genetic mutation, one of the genetic mutations that causes Dravet syndrome. So we're studying that, and we haven't begun any experiments on the mice with cannabis, but we've planned to do that. And the problem is that I think that the reluctance is partly political, but partly also because the scientific evidence is not strong that it will work. But the problem with Dravet syndrome is that it's many, many different disorders that all can cause Dravet syndrome. There's 600 mutations that have been identified in a single one of the genes, a sodium channel, that can do this. So it may very well be that any individual patient may benefit, but as a population, when you study a population of patients, you can't prove that. Mm-hmm. So I think that it's reasonable to try it, but I think there's not good proof of when.
Maria LaFrance, tell me, before we have to go in a few seconds, what will you be doing in the coming weeks as the Iowa legislature convenes in this regard?
I'm going to continue to educate the public, ask them to talk to their legislators and their state and local legislators, especially those in the rural areas. There's actually more research for cancer, MS, Crohn's, and anorexia than there is for epilepsy. So let's leave the science up to the scientists, and let's try to legalize it so that we can research it. You know, when it breaks my heart when people say there's not enough research. They can't research it because it's illegal. We need to change that.
Do you have a state that you look to that has ideals, an ideal model in terms of law that you would look to, Maria?
Well, the Iowa Board of Pharmacy recommended the New Mexico program, so I'm kind of deferring to them. But really, the most freedom is in Oregon. They've got a great program, wonderful, fantastic doctors studying it. The University of, is it San Francisco in California?
Okay.
Obtained a Schedule I license so that they can research it and grow it at the university.
Okay. Maria LaFrance, thank you very much for joining us. We have to go now. Roxanne Kojil, thank you for joining us in our Des Moines studio as well.
Yes, thank you.
Dr. George Richardson of the University of Iowa, professor, chair of neurology as well. Perhaps quickly, can you tell us how people can find out more about SUDEP the best way?
The Epilepsy Foundation or the SUDEP Institute websites.
Okay, Dr. Richardson, thank you for coming into our studio. Teresa Elliott from our first half in our studio as well. Thank you for coming in and sharing the story of your son so that others may learn. Thank you.
You're welcome.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and Lindsay Moon. In Des Moines, we had help from John Pemble. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We always love you to contact us with your questions and comments. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.